Good morning and welcome to the Acromegaly Update for Monday, June 22nd, 2026. I'm your host, and today we have a genuinely strong week to cover: six new acromegaly papers from the peer-reviewed literature, and in our industry segment, a striking pattern of FDA reversals that's reshaping the landscape for rare disease gene therapy developers. Let's get into it. Segment 1: Acromegaly Research. We'll start with a study that asks a question that's been underexplored for too long. What does decades of growth hormone excess actually do to the kidneys? Researchers at a single Turkish tertiary center published in Pituitary this week a retrospective analysis of nearly 400 acromegaly patients followed over 40 years. They mapped out the prevalence of renal cysts, chronic kidney disease, and urinary system malignancies, and used multivariate modeling to identify independent predictors of each. This is the kind of longitudinal breadth you almost never get in a rare endocrine disease, and it matters because acromegaly management tends to be dominated by cardiovascular and pituitary concerns, leaving renal surveillance guidelines somewhat underdeveloped. If you're managing patients with long-standing disease or suboptimal biochemical control, this paper is worth a close read for what it tells you about renal risk stratification. Still in Pituitary, and also published this week, a South Korean group reported on a subtype of acromegaly that doesn't get nearly enough attention: tumors that co-secrete both growth hormone and prolactin. These GH-prolactin co-secreting pituitary tumors represent a biologically distinct entity, and this study directly compared their clinical course and remission outcomes against pure GH-secreting tumors. The bottom line is not reassuring. Co-secreting tumors defined a higher risk phenotype with worse remission rates and a more aggressive clinical trajectory. This matters practically because identifying GH-prolactin co-secretion at diagnosis could flag the patients who need earlier escalation to combination medical therapy or more aggressive surveillance. It also reinforces a broader principle that's been gaining traction: that acromegaly is not one disease but several, and molecular tumor characterization should be part of the workup from day one. Which brings us to the third paper this week, and it's the one I'd most strongly recommend reading in full. Published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, it's a clinical review on precision medicine-guided evaluation and treatment of acromegaly. The authors, led by Puig Domingo and colleagues, take direct aim at the traditional stepwise model where first-generation somatostatin receptor ligands go in first for essentially everyone, followed by empirical dose escalation and trial-and-error combination strategies that can leave patients in biochemical excess for years. They argue, drawing on cluster analyses that have now been replicated across multiple cohorts, that acromegaly patients sort into three main subtypes with distinct drug response profiles, and that upfront tumor profiling, looking at somatostatin receptor expression, AIP mutation status, and granulation pattern, should guide initial drug selection. For anyone thinking about where newer agents like paltusotine fit in the treatment algorithm, or when to reach for pasireotide or pegvisomant earlier, this review is essential context. Moving to the fourth paper, published in the European Journal of Endocrinology this week, researchers took a careful look at how the renin-angiotensin system, the main hormonal regulator of blood pressure, responds to growth hormone at different exposure durations. Using both healthy volunteers exposed to short-term GH excess and a cohort of acromegaly patients representing long-term excess, they found that the renin-angiotensin system is actually activated early but repressed chronically. That's a bimodal pattern that elegantly reconciles a lot of conflicting prior data and helps explain why blood pressure in acromegaly behaves in complex, sometimes counterintuitive ways. For clinicians managing hypertension in acromegaly patients, and for researchers thinking about cardiovascular endpoints in clinical trials, this mechanistic piece fills an important gap. Fifth, this week, another study from Pituitary in another Turkish cohort. This time, 393 patients followed from 1980 through 2023, asking the question of whether acromegaly confers an elevated cancer risk. This is a perennially contested area, because surveillance bias is a serious confounder. People with acromegaly get more imaging and more endoscopies, so cancers that would otherwise go undetected are found. This group took that challenge seriously, building in sensitivity analyses with thyroid cancer exclusions, graded landmark time points, and reference rate variation. The use of standardized incidence ratios against Turkish national cancer rates gives this a methodological rigor you don't always see in acromegaly cancer studies. The results add to the evidence base that will eventually clarify whether cancer screening protocols in acromegaly need to go beyond thyroid surveillance. And sixth, Kasuki and Heck published a paper in Pituitary presenting what appears to be a large series of acromegaly patients on long-term pegvisomant monotherapy. The abstract was not yet available at time of recording, but the title promises reassuring efficacy and safety data. Pegvisomant, the GH receptor antagonist that works upstream of IGF-1, remains the most potent biochemical normalizer we have, and it's often underused because of concerns about long-term tolerability. Data reinforcing its safety profile over extended follow-up should strengthen the case for earlier deployment in patients who aren't reaching target IGF-1 on somatostatin analogs. Now, zooming out from acromegaly to the wider rare disease industry, this week brought two striking regulatory reversals at the FDA, and together they feel less like coincidence and more like a policy signal. The first involves Unicor and their gene therapy for Huntington's disease called AMT-130. Back in March, the FDA dealt the company a serious blow, ruling that the 3-year analysis from their phase 1 study was not sufficient to support a filing for accelerated approval, a decision that sent the stock down sharply and left the Huntington's patient community deeply frustrated. This week, Unicor announced that after meeting with the FDA again, the agency reversed its position. The same 3-year data set the agency had previously rejected will now serve as the primary basis for a biologics license application under accelerated approval. Unicor plans to file that application in the third quarter of this year. The stock surged 80% on the news. There are still open questions. The FDA wants agreement on the confirmatory trial design before the filing goes in, with the agency preferring a concurrent standard of care control rather than the sham procedure that had been discussed. But the direction of travel is unmistakable. The agency is becoming significantly more willing to accept early phase data as the evidentiary anchor for rare disease accelerated approvals. The second reversal involves RegenxBio and their gene therapy for Hunter syndrome, also known as MPS2. This is a rare, progressive lysosomal storage disorder where children with the neurological form face relentless cognitive decline because the enzyme replacement therapy that treats the systemic disease simply cannot cross the blood-brain barrier into the brain. The FDA had rejected RegenxBio's gene therapy just 4 months ago. This morning, today, June 22nd, RegenxBio announced that the FDA will reconsider. That's a stunning turnaround, and it follows last week's reversal for Unicor. Both companies' situations share a common thread. Their prior rejections came under FDA leadership installed during the Trump administration, including former Commissioner Marty McCurry and CBER Director Vinay Prasad, both of whom have since departed the agency. The new leadership appears to be taking a fundamentally different view of how much evidence is sufficient to greenlight rare disease therapies with no other options. For rare disease drug developers broadly, including anyone working in ultra-rare CNS indications, lysosomal storage disorders, or other conditions where powering a traditional phase 3 trial is nearly impossible, the message from this week is one worth sitting with. The FDA door that felt closed a few months ago appears to be reopening. Stepping back to tie both segments together, the Precision Medicine Review in JCM and the regulatory reversals at the FDA share a common thread, and it's worth naming it. Both are pushing in the direction of using more granular, earlier stage evidence to make treatment decisions, one at the level of individual tumor biology, the other at the level of regulatory policy. In a field like acromegaly, where heterogeneous tumor subtypes respond differently to the same drugs, and in a regulatory environment where accelerated approval on phase 1 half data is becoming more attainable, the companies and clinical programs that invest in deep molecular characterization early are likely to have a meaningful advantage. Watch for that theme to play out in trial designs and filings over the next 12 to 18 months. That's your acromegaly update for June 22nd, 2026. We'll be back next week with more from the literature and the industry. Thanks for listening.